Welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 14th of August 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, I'm afraid we don't have Dennis here with us this week. He is still ill, and he would like me to say thank you very much to all the people that have been wishing him well. I can let you know that he doesn't have COVID, which is something to be thankful for, but he is still unable to make the podcast with me tonight. So what I've done is I've edited together some previous podcasts that we did talking about Heinrich Himmler. So hopefully, it's not as good as some original content from us, but at least it's put together in ways that are different to how you have heard it before. So here we go with a remixed version of myself and Dennis Wise talking about Heinrich Himmler.
I know you've been digging into all sorts for part 19, haven't you? Particularly Heinrich Himmler, which we're going to get into tonight.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that before we get into it?
Well, the reason I just went for start off with Himmler was that he's the poster boy, obviously, for all the pagans who believed that National Socialism was not Christian but was paganism. There's some intrusive elements of that, but the overall majority, as what we're going to show in this video and previous ones, is that Christianity, or rather the Bible, was at war with the Talmud. Simple as that, really.
Yeah, I think that sums it up, really. The Bible at war with the Talmud, because Christianity, yep. you've got Protestantism, you've got Catholicism, you've got clericalism, you've got the traditional church. But that's what it boils down to, really, is the Bible. And people who hold to that more than anything else against people mm-hmm. that hold to the Talmud. And you've been kind enough to furnish me with the script for it, basically, yep. the provisional script for it. So we're going to go through that and we're going to elaborate on things from these quotes that we've got here. And the first one, I think this is one that we actually used last week or in the last episode. And this is from Franz von Papen, Chancellor of Germany.
You won't know that. To be honest, I already had it down, but yeah, it's a fair place, a great, great quote.
And he was one of the guys that signed the Concordat, wasn't he?
Instrumentally signed it, yeah.
Yeah, and he said the Third Reich is the first power which not only recognises but puts into practice the principles of the papacy. He said that in 1932. Correct. And what he meant by that was getting rid of usury, removing Jews from public office, preventing Jews from marrying Christians, putting Jews in their own separate area. All these things that we're told Hitler did that were so terrible was basically just what the Catholic Church had been doing for the last almost 2,000 years, which only stopped, I guess, about the time of the French Revolution. I guess they sort of stopped what the church was doing.
Well, they were struggling a bit after that, weren't they?
Yeah. When was it that the Second Reich finished? I think it was 1800 and something, wasn't it?
1806, if I'm right.
1806. Because this is what a lot of people miss as well. I mean, the Third Reich, what it meant was the Third Holy Roman Empire. Holy.
That's right.
Being the important word in that. It was Christian. It mm-hmm. wasn't pagan. Well, let's have a look at these quotes that we've got from Himmler. This is the first one. And this is from Die Schutzstaffel aus Anti-Bolshevismus Kampforganisation, the SS as an anti-Bolshevik fighting organisation. And Himmler says, in this, obeying unalterable laws are included the sacred belief of our ancestors, that everything on this earth was created by God and inspired by God. Only foolish, malicious, and stupid people created this pagan fable, the horror stories that our ancestors worshipped gods and trees. No, they were convinced in God's ancient knowledge and ancient teachings of his divine order of this world, wherein we were created in his image, and where the plant and the animal world coexist. And this is something that, you know, I've been saying for quite a while. The idea that our ancestors would have worshipped the sun or worshipped idols, I mean, they just weren't that stupid. They knew that the sun didn't give us life. There was something beyond that. And if you look at the Druids, mm-hmm. the Druids refused to worship Caesar. They refused to worship the Roman gods. They just thought all of that was beneath them. And I dare say the Saxons probably did as well. You know, a lot of these barbarians, I mean, the Romans banned Druidry and they banned Christianity. You know, so there's obviously a link between the two of them. But this idea that we would worship inanimate objects, you know, that's always seemed a little bit silly to me. I like Himmler was saying here, they could see that God had created all of this. So why would you then worship something that he had created? And it's that same mentality that says, why would you worship Caesar? Why would you worship a man? You know, you want to worship God that created the man.
The greater being, yeah.
Yeah, and when you look at sun worship, it's always associated with non-white races. And a lot of the time it's also associated with cannibalism and human sacrifice, if you look in South America. And that wasn't what our ancestors were doing. The sun was a symbol for life or a symbol for God, and particularly the black sun. Because that was saying that this is spiritual light. This is the God is like a sun that we cannot see, that is far more powerful than our material sun that we need to give us life. And you know, the real sun, the sun that we look at, that's like a shadow of the black sun. It's like a shadow of the force that gives us life. So it's good to have this quote here. We'll get into more of that later on. Let's carry on with Himmler here. We've got some more from him in Ideological Training. He says, I forbid every attack on Christ as a person, since such attacks or insults that Christ was a Jew are unworthy of us and are certainly historically not true. And that was in 1938 that he said that in Berlin. So it's not like, you know, he's changed his views in that time.
Yeah, that's 2 years after he left the Catholic Church. So he still felt the same way.
Well, I've got a quote here, which I'm going to have to read from a book, so bear with the rustling. Sure. And this is something that he said before he actually joined the NSDAP, and this is to do with the church. He wrote in his diary, come what may, I shall always love God, shall pray to him and shall remain faithful to the Catholic Church and shall defend it, even if I should be expelled from it. And didn't he have the last rites or something? Some connection he still had with the church right at the very end? What was that, Dennis?
I'm not so sure, because I was looking up on that as well. And it seems they took a death mask of him, and it seems there was some real heavy bruising on his face. I think he was beaten to death. I think that's the consensus, whoever, you know, sees this mask. And not the cyanide story we were given, so sorry to say.
But did he still have a connection to the church right till the end? Did they say anything for him like they did for Hitler?
Not that I'm aware of, but again, I could be wrong. I mean, these things, after 5 years of Germany being closed after the war, a lot of things were hidden, a lot of things were buried and burnt, and so it is difficult to find out true information. But every now and again, you know, like the Untermeyer speech, it's thrown up, you know.
Well, we do know that he did leave the church, although he still seemed to have remained loyal to Christianity. And we've actually got, and this comes from the book The Holy Reich, Nazi Conceptions of Christianity by Richard Steigman Gull here that I'm quoting from. And this is actually what Hitler had to say about Himmler's new views. Just as Hitler had no time for Rosenberg's plans to create a new mystical religion to replace clerical Christianity, so he found Himmler's dilettantish religious explorations absurd. As he told a circle of confidants, what nonsense. Here we have at last reached an age that has left all mysticism behind, and now he wants to start that all over again. To think that someday I may be turned into an SS saint, exclamation mark there. Whereas Himmler, yeah, I mean, that is pretty much what some people try to do today, isn't it? Make him out to be a saint. Whereas Himmler attacked Charlemagne as an agent of Christianity against pagan Germanic tribes, Hitler declared killing all those Saxons was not a historical crime, as Himmler thinks. Charlemagne did a good thing in subjugating Widukund and killing the Saxons out of hand. He thereby made possible the empire of the Franks and the entry of Western culture into what is now Germany. Hitler was equally dismissive of Himmler's forays into German prehistory. Isn't it enough that the Romans were erecting great buildings when our forefathers were still living in mud huts? Now Himmler is starting to dig up these villages of mud huts and enthusing over every pot shard and stone axe he finds. According to Albert Speer, the whole thing was beginning to assume far-fetched pseudo-religious forms. Goebbels, with Hitler, took the lead in ridiculing these dreams of Himmler's, with Himmler himself adding to the comedy by his vanity and obsessiveness. Hitler even approached Himmler himself in 1935, fully rejecting the foundation of a new religion, calling it a chimera. Rather than attack Himmler frontally, however, he took the indirect route of attacking Himmler's paganist ally Rosenberg, stating that he intended to take action against Rosenberg's mythos. So, I mean, I don't think Himmler can really have been taking this too seriously.
No.
Because it's very light-hearted mocking there, isn't it, and ridicule of him.
Yeah, just the fact that he's looking into it is enough to get, you know, Hitler's mocking.
I mean, it's also got a bit here that Himmler feared that the average SS man would be unable to distinguish between attacks on the churches and a preservation of Christ. Therefore, in a 1937 memorandum marked to all SS leaders from Standartenfuhrer upwards, Himmler instructed, "In ideological training, I forbid every attack against Christ as a person, since such attacks or insults that Christ was a Jew are unworthy of us, and certainly untrue historically." He then added significantly, "I desire that SS men be convinced of the worth of our own blood and our past through knowledge of the actual history of our folk, the prehistory of our folk, the greatness and culture of our ancestors, so that they will totally root themselves in the value of the past, present and future. Not only Christ, but belief in Christ as a part of German history was to be respected in the SS. Such proclamations were not simply for public consumption. When a member of the Hitler Youth wrote to Himmler asking if he was to believe a Nazi lecturer who claimed that Jesus was a Jew, Himmler's secretary Rudolf Brandt replied, indicating that the Reichsfuhrer SS is of the conviction that Jesus was not a Jew. You must have misunderstood the speaker." So it's quite clear there what was going on. I think Hitler was against clericalism, wasn't he?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it wasn't a thing about faith.
It was about church leaders interfering in politics more than anything
else. Yeah, which was not their place.
And also changing what the Bible says. You know, ignoring what the Bible says. Yeah. What we get today when they promote sodomy, or, you know, they say, oh, well, the Jews didn't kill Jesus. It was the Romans, or the Jews weren't responsible. And that's clericalism as well. It's the priests trying to change tradition.
Yeah, it wasn't just Himmler. I think in 1936, I think it all came about. I think Reinhard Heydrich was another one who left for the same reasons. I think a couple left. But we did stress to the SS that not to follow suit, because this wasn't about faith. It was about, you know, he's an enemy, like, of this clerical stuff.
Yeah, he was against that more than anything else. People are often confused with Himmler and the Ahnenerbe, a group of scholars that he gathered to study the ancient Aryans, which when translated into English means ancestral heritage and not pagan heritage. If it was pagan, it would be called Heidnischen Erbe. Now, I've heard this before. I've had people come up to me before and say, well, what about this pagan heritage that he was studying?
Yep.
But it's not. It's just ancestral heritage.
Correct.
It's like the use of the runes. That was the old Saxon language. There wasn't anything mystical about it, about the use of it. We're just saying that that's part of our history. So we'll use these runes to show that we weren't illiterate. We were able to write back when there were Saxons. We got the same thing over here in Britain. We've got Ogham is what it's called.
And
it's,
really?
Yeah, it's like lines that are carved into the corner part of a stone, like grooves that are cut into it. And you get a lot of stones in Wales and in Ireland that have these grooves cut into them, and you can read. And what it basically shows is that we had our own form of writing at the time when the Romans were here. And it's the same with the Saxons. They had their form of writing. They had these runes back then.
Yeah, it's amazing, really, isn't it? What we don't know.
We also got all the interest in the traditions that they had. I mean, they tried to revive a lot of traditions. The Midsummer's Day one that they had, and they tried to. They didn't just have the Christian traditions, but also the pre-Christian traditions, because it was all German heritage. You know, this is something that I don't think a lot of pagans really seem to get, that Christians and pagans were exactly the same people. It's not like, you know, a foreign force invaded a country and forced everybody to become Christian. The people in the country didn't change. They themselves decided that they would do things in the Christian way, which was more of a like an evolution of what they had been doing, rather than, you know, a complete break with the past. The proof of that is the fact that we still have all these traditions, things like Christmas, things like Easter. The angels of some of the angels were Christianized gods from the past. Oh, that shows that there wasn't a huge break with what we were doing before. It shows that there was a continuation of it.
Well, what that also shows to people who were against religion, they're saying that look at the Catholic Church celebrating Christmas when it's pagan, and they twist it so that people start to believe that the Catholic Church was never Christian at all, which obviously is wrong.
And what it is European people celebrating a European festival, and the Europeans celebrated it whether they were pagan or whether they were Christian, because the central part to it is that it was European. That's the thing. That's what people get mixed up with today. They think, oh, Christianity must be foreign. Christianity must come from the Jews. And that's just not true.
Well, they do say that, don't they? That's one of the favourite lines. We're not following that Jew cook. Obviously, it's Jesus.
When Christianity began, Judea was part of the Roman Empire, and Europe pretty much stretched all the way out over to there. What was the Middle East now? Constantinople used to be the centre of Christendom, and that's Istanbul in Turkey. So instead of just having white people like we do now in Europe, you had white people out there in the Middle East, out there in the Near East as well. You still had some all the way over there in India. The white world itself was much larger than it is today. And we had connections to that. We had trade routes. We had trade with Rome. We had trade with Jerusalem. I mean, it's written into the English Chronicle. It talks about one of the high priests in Jerusalem at the time in the Old Testament. And it links it to what's actually going on in Britain at the time, which shows you that we were connected to these people because they were all white, basically. They were all white people. Himmler in 1936 left the Catholic Church, insisting that no one in the SS should follow suit. He claimed his departure was not about his faith, but that he had become anti-clerical towards the Church. He remained a Christian until his death in 1945. Hence the reason for his protective statement on Jesus Christ only 2 years after leaving the church. So you say there he remained a Christian until his death. That's what I was wondering. Where you got, you know, what makes you think that, Dennis?
Well, the fact that you know he's still thinking that, you know, Jesus Christ is his God, even after he's left the church. There's nothing to show that he changed his mind since then.
And he wrote that in the diary as well, didn't he? That even if he left the church, he would still remain a Christian
and
a Catholic. So I think he was probably interested in all these, you know, these pre-Christian things, the same as he was interested in Aryans all around the world and the history of Aryans all around the world. And it's the same as I'm interested in all of this, but I'm still a Christian. It doesn't make me not a Christian to be interested in, you know, the earlier white religions and what we can learn from them. It just means that you...
Well, that's right. I mean, I haven't been to church in God knows how long. I mean, and I know what the church is today, but it doesn't alter the fact, although I no longer belong to the church, I am a Christian.
And you try to obey the Christian laws. I mean, that's what all of European law is based upon, is these Christian laws.
Years, yeah.
And when you look at... if you look at someone like Alfred the Great, and he collected the oldest laws together. And apparently the oldest laws in Britain were written in the 6th century BC by Molnutius. And he wrote down the laws that we had then. They were called the usages of the country. And they evolved into something called the triads, which was quite easy to remember. There was usually sort of three things to remember in each one. And then Alfred the Great wrote those down. And when he was writing them down, he said, you know, these are the same as the laws of the Old Testament and the Ten Commandments. And they were just sort of written in a different way. And in his introduction to it, he comments on this as well, that, you know, that the Saxons or the English, they already had these same laws that that Christians had, which shows you again this connection between the Israelites and also with the Europeans, because we had the same laws. Honor your father and your mother, that your days in the land may be long. I mean, that's saying be a nationalist. It's not saying just honor your immediate mother and father, but you've got to honor all your mothers and all your fathers if you want to live a healthy life and keep the land that the Lord has given you.
I've got to say something later on. Carry on, sorry. My mind went blank.
Well, I was going to say, and you've got, you know, they don't covet after your neighbor's wife, no idolatry, one day off a week. I mean, all of that was written down in these
laws. Yeah, I thought what I'm going to say now, it was the fact that people say we don't need Ten Commandments to know what's right and wrong. And to a certain degree, I suppose you're right. Well, the problem comes when you get different degrees of right and wrong. Some people think what is wrong, others won't. And that's when you get the problem where people like Crowley, for instance, took it way beyond what any normal person would believe was right.
And also then you get, well, what are you saying there, that man can make up his own law?
Well, that's what they're saying.
Well, if man can make up his own law, then who's to say that one man's law is right and another man's law is wrong, is false? Correct. You know, you have to have laws that come from God, really. I mean, this is the point of this. I think we understood a lot more back then that all of this could only have come from God. It could only have come from the Holy Spirit. There's nowhere else it could have come from. You know, it couldn't have been dreamt up by people back then. Now, even the idea, I mean, this was pointed out to me by Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, that, you know, when it says in the beginning there was nothing in the Bible, I mean, that was centuries before the concept of zero actually existed, before this mathematical construct of zero, of nothing, before it existed. And yet there it is in the book of Genesis, centuries before they had this concept. So that, you know, it could only have come from God through the Holy Spirit. And these laws.
Well, I would hate to live rules by the Stone Age, where, you know, if somebody fancies your wife, they're just going to come on and check them to beat you up. That's what we're heading for.
You know, even the dietary laws were incredibly sensible. And you wouldn't have known, you know, a lot of them. But they're all very, very, very sensible laws. All of it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of them were based on protecting Christianity. They want servants under a certain age, serving Jews and things like that, just to protect, because they knew the danger of Christianity was in if the, like, you know, the Jews and the Muslims ever got close to overtaking them, which obviously happens on today.
Well, the church said that Jews couldn't have Christian servants. That was one of their laws, and they said that Jews couldn't marry Christians, Jews couldn't hold public office, they couldn't teach, they weren't allowed to indulge in usury for the first 1,000 years.
That's right. The Catholic Church was the only one to oppose them. out of all the organisations, can't think of one other.
Yeah, once the church split, and then you had Protestantism, none of the Protestants really fought against usury. I'm not sure what happened with the Eastern Orthodox, how strongly they fought against usury, but right up until 10, I think it was 1066, something like that, or 1060, until 1060, the church was united. So the Eastern Orthodox Church and what became the Roman Catholic Church and the Celtic Church, they were all just one church. It was called the Catholic Church, just one church. And then in 1060,
the Normans brought up the Jews in, didn't they, I think?
Yeah, the Normans 66. Brought the Jews in. Yeah. And that's what really sort of did it for Britain. And then in 1260, 1290,
around that time. Came along.
Yeah, yeah, that was when Edward I got rid of them. I had someone say the other day, oh, wasn't he a really bad guy? I thought, well, you know, it depends how you look at it. If you look at it from Hollywood's point of view, they always portray him as a bad guy.
But if you look in favor.
Yeah, but if you look in British history, it says that in the Chronicles of England, it says that after he got rid of the Jews, everyone in the country all paid him a penny in gratitude for doing that.
Really?
Yeah. So, a penny must have been quite a fair old bit back then. It wasn't a tax. It was just, you know, given out of the goodness of their hearts to say thank you.
Yeah, it's just you've saved us more than this.
A lot more. Now, tonight, Dennis, you've got this really, really interesting interview with Gudrun Himmler, Heinrich Himmler's daughter, that we're going to be talking about.
Yeah.
Where did you come across this?
An old friend of mine who constantly sends me material. I have one or two people who send me material, and this one came through. Sent me a couple, actually. Sent me the daughter of Hermann Göring as well. But this one in particular really struck me and surprised me how close I was to the truth, because she's talking virtually, practically, exactly the same as I went down that road in the secret Masonic victory. And I couldn't believe that I got so close.
So you hadn't, you hadn't really sort of come across her before? Had you heard of anything?
Any information from this at all? No, this is the first time I'd read it, which was only a couple of days ago, and I was stunned.
But apparently she, after the war, she survived the war, and she's continually spoken up and said, everything that people have been told about the war is a lie. And she's one of those few people that refused to go along with it. And said, no, there weren't gas chambers. No, there wasn't a Holocaust. And the National Socialists were the good guys. And she kept that up for her whole life. I mean, this is a really noble, honourable, courageous woman here. And she does. The story she tells is much closer to what you've been showing on Freemasonic Victory than a lot of National Socialists will say about her father, Heinrich Himmler, as we'll see as we get into this. But this interview was... it took place in Munich in 1992, and Gudrun Himmler was Gudrun Berwitz by then. She was born on August the 8th, 1929, and died on May the 24th, 2018, at the symbolic age of 88. And she was 63 years old when she did this interview. And when you think, well, she was born in 1929. So she was a teenager, basically, when the war was on. So it's not like she was listening to her father and all the others when she was a toddler. She was a teenager. She was biologically, she was an adult. So I think we can trust her memories. And being a teenager, she would have been very inquisitive, and she would have picked up on things. She would have picked up on things that maybe the adults didn't want her to know about. So for people to say, well, she would have had all the bad things hidden from her, I don't think that were possible. I mean, these bad things we say weren't true, but even if they were, they wouldn't have been able to keep that hidden from an inquisitive young teenager that had access everywhere. I mean, she was walking around the work camps. She was involved in everything that her father was involved in at work. He took a very, very close interest in her. So she had access to just about everything, and her story is completely different. Yes, an interesting woman. Well, the first section that she talks about is the Jews.
And she's been asked about Heinrich Himmler and what he thought about the Jews. And she says, I heard him speak about how after the war, Jews would be released and resettled to either Palestine, Madagascar, or deep into Russia, where they came into Europe from several hundred years ago. Understanding who these people are is key to solving the problems that a nation has. They have distinct racial features like dark hair, hooked noses, big ears, and beady eyes. And while they may look European to a degree, they work to destroy what Europeans have built religiously and culturally. My father was a policeman. He had a deep sense of right and wrong and expected his men to follow the law in a uniform manner. He gave a speech, which I attended, where I heard him exalt and chastise his officers regarding not policing fairly. And I'll just stop there because we often forget that. I mean, he was a policeman. And, you know, policemen joined the police to go after the bad guys and protect the good guys. And, you know, they take a lot of risks. And he was at the head of this. So what she's saying here would be true. You know, he would have a deep sense of right and wrong. She heard him praising his officers, and she also saw him chastising them for not being fair.
Well, he left the Catholic Church as well because he didn't believe if some things what was going on was right. So again, that doesn't surprise me
because he didn't think the church was acting fairly.
Yeah, that's right. You know, they'd. In his eyes, they kind of let the Jews dictate the Bible and get away with it.
Well, and she's also pointed out, you know, the plan was after the war to resettle the Jews in Palestine, Madagascar, or deep into Russia. So that was obviously talked about. That was quite open that was the plan. Continuing, she says, everyone had friends and everyone had the good Jew, in which they were hesitant to enforce the removals to ghettos and work camps. He told them that the SD was uncovering so much espionage and illegal activity in even the good Jews that they must all be moved to where they could be better watched. Therefore, Germany, like many other nations, moved aliens who were deemed a threat to the war effort to areas where they could be concentrated together and watched. Nothing sinister, evil, or wrong with protecting your people and nation during times of war. You no doubt will bring up the photos next, which tie into the eyewitness stories. Many inmates died in these camps, but not because of a policy of killing or neglect. And that's an important point. I mean, it's still the same today. People say, well, what about Nathaniel Kapner? What about Henry Macker? What about these so-called good Jews? But there's always something, there's always something in the story that they miss, that they're covering up for. And why would you want to have Jews speaking up for us anyway? We have our own people that can speak up for us. Jews can look out for Jewish interests, which they're very good at doing. And we can look out for our interests. And it's interesting here that she was saying that what was happening, these people that others were saying, oh, well, these he's a good Jew, this one, even they were concerned with espionage and illegal activity because their loyalty is to other Jews.
Well, the thing is that, you know, when there's a war going on and you realise there is some of these so-called good Jews helping the Allies, there's no way that you can actually, you know, uproot them all. So the easiest way is just to collect them all together, and then that way, then you know that things aren't being leaked. I think that was the idea.
Well, yeah, so you can keep an eye on them. And as she was saying, that's just the same as every other nation did. If you have a...
Japan in America suffered, American Japanese really suffered in some of the camps. The guards looked on them as rats and treat them so.
Oh, you think in Britain, you know, if there had been any Germans in Britain at the time of the war, they would have been interned. The same as in Germany. They had Jews in Germany at the time of the war, so they were interned because the Jews were against them. They declared war against them, the economic boycott. They were massively involved in this, and a large portion of them were communist sympathisers. The Jews that...
They were the problem, yeah.
I mean, they had Michelin Jews as well, and the Michelin Jews were... Some of them were fighting in the war effort. You know, they were actually fighting on the side of the Germans. So it's not like it was all Jews. It was communist Jews, basically.
Yeah, partisans.
She says, one thing that seemed to pain my father was that the Allies bombed some of the camps, killing inmates. Because of the bombing of Europe, especially in the final months of the war, necessities that were needed in the camps could not get through, and many prisoners who came west were sick, and terrible outbreaks happened in a couple of the camps in which these prisoners were put in. Belsen was a prime example. I cannot state enough that there was no policy to kill innocent people simply because of racial ideas. There were many partisans and criminals who were killed, some in the camps and some after being rounded up, but this had nothing to do with exterminating a race. Father hated seeing death in wartime, but he was a policeman who knew his duty and knew what he asked of his officers was a hard duty. But when people break the laws of war and kill innocents, they too must be held accountable, and those who help them. So this was a point. The people that were killed were executed. They were executed for breaking the law, for being criminals, for being terrorists. It's like when we were talking about that escape to victory with the British prisoners of war, when they escaped, and when they report that today, they say, oh, and Hitler had them all murdered. Well, no, they were escaped prisoners of war. They were the enemy, and they had escaped from their prison. So the rules of law are they should be shot because they're a threat, because they're just going to get hold of a weapon and kill Germans.
I think I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, especially on Belsen as well, when Ernst Sundel interviewed a British medic who had never been asked for his opinion after the war. None of the newspapers approached him because he simply said it how it was, and he was talking away, and he was saying, what probably happened was the propaganda was so bad that when the British did turn up, as they did, typhus had broken out and there were bodies all over the place. But it wasn't just that. They had these gangs of communists who kind of took all the food as well, which we spoke about. And he said he there was no gas chambers at Belsen, and he never heard of any others in any other place. So this all ties up again with this British medic.
So the communists that were in there, they were taking all the food that should have actually gone to the other prisoners.
Tough guys, yeah. I mean, these were, you know, out and out communist tough guys.
And you also had the bombing of the railroads. I mean, she's talking here in the final months of the war, and if all the if the communications are down, the roads have been bombed, the railways have been bombed, and you can't actually get any of the medical necessities, the food that you need, actually into the prisons. And there was one bit, I'm not sure if I actually took the quote there, and she was sort of joking and saying that somebody that was actually in one of these camps was saying that they're better off in the camps than they are outside, because at least they are being fed. I mean, if you're thinking of the people that are living there on the outside, you know, they may not have been able to get food. They may not have been able to get medicine. But at least when you're in these camps, there was these regular deliveries, and there had to be enough that was delivered because there was enough for the officers and enough for the workers there. And the actual number of officers to workers was very, very small, she points out as well. And I don't know, there must have been some research done into that. Do you know anything about that, Dennis, about whether there was just, you know, just a few of the officers compared to the number of prisoners or workers that there were in the camps?
Well, I'm pretty sure that the officers were outnumbered by those in the camp. I was talking about a law that Hitler had brought out saying that if any of the camps prisoners escaped, to shoot everybody, because he didn't want them going into the nearest town and causing havoc. Well, apparently this did happen, and some did break away. It must have overpowered the guards, and they were arrested eventually by the Americans after they'd caused some real problems. But they were only sent back into you know, the camp, but not really strictly watched. They were still regarded as enemies of the Nazis.
Well, you'd have to make an example.
You know, the Americans massacred at least 50 SS up against the wall, which we covered in Greater Story.
So when you think about it, if you've got a prisoner of war camp and some of them escape, you know, you're going to have to punish them so that the others don't do the same thing. Or if they attack a guard, say you've got one prison guard for every 10 prisoners, and a load of prisoners beat one of these guards up, they have to be really severely dealt with, because the whole lot could suddenly attack these guards, which and outnumber them 10 to 1.
And there were young lads. I can remember a picture, again, in The Greatest Story, of a young lad alive 1 minute in his SS uniform, and then a couple of minutes later, it shows him dead on the ground, battered. All his face is puffed out. Could still make him out, like a ginger hair. But yeah, certainly they were set on by these prisoners.
And of course, you couldn't treat them that badly because of that as well. If you treat them badly, then they're likely to riot. And you have the same problem with the prisons today. What I like to compare is however many officers they have in a modern prison for however many prisoners, and compare it to how many officers they had in these work camps, to how many workers. Because I bet that there's probably about 10 times less, I would say, today.
I would say so, even though we're on demand in today's prisons.
They probably have something like one officer to every 10 prisoners, say, in the prisons today. And I would guess that they probably have something like one officer to every 50 prisoners in these camps.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
You know, relying on good behaviour, basically. Relying on treating them with dignity, and expecting the officers to be treated with dignity as well. Well, the next person she brings up is Reinhard Heydrich. This is really interesting. She says, there is a difference between National Socialism and German rule. You no doubt are referring to my father's good friend Reinhard Heydrich when you speak of Czechoslovakia. He was assassinated because he was so good to the people. It is a good study of the way the Allies twist history to their liking and use the Czechs as pawns. They were ruled by Germany and under occupation, which many did not like, but it had nothing to do with National Socialism. Heydrich brought National Socialist ideas to the people and vastly started to improve their lives during a war in which everyone had to sacrifice. And I'll just stop there, because that, you know, we don't often think about that, because of course they're going to resent the fact that they're being occupied by Germany, but the system, the National Socialist system, was seen as a good system and was of benefit. I mean, that's of benefit to everyone to have a National Socialist system. What do you know about Reinhard Heydrich, Dennis?
Another high-ranking Catholic. Was probably groomed to take over from Hitler at some point. Certainly, you know, the right hand of Himmler. And he's been, obviously, demonised by the Allies. But again, you know, I mean, we're just getting one side of a story. And this is another side of a story which I always felt was nearer the mark. But Czechoslovakia, again, was a difficult place, you've got to remember, because Germans were getting trouble early on. That's why Hitler kind of moved in for the Munich Agreement. So after the war, it was even worse. These so-called partisans, or resistance, as we say, they seemed to be all Jews, whether in France or Czechoslovakia, and, you know, they're going to reap revenge then.
So the people that were actually under occupation, like the French or the Czechs, they were sort of quite happy with the National Socialist ideas. And then you've got the Jews, who obviously aren't happy with the National Socialist ideas, and they form the core of the terrorist faction. So, of course, when the National Socialists go after the terrorists, you're getting a large percentage of Jews that are these terrorists. So, again, it's not going after people because they're Jewish, but going after them because they're a threat to the Germans.
Communist, yeah.
Yeah. She continues, he was assigned to govern an occupied people, but because he brought in a better standard for farmers and workers, the people were very receptive to his leadership. He came to be very liked and respected. My father wanted to model his style for all occupied areas to turn the people to our side. The English claim he was so evil and bad, a hangman sending thousands to their deaths. It was so bad, they claim, they had to train a kill team to go in and kill the murderer. The problem with his story is that if he was so bad to the people, The Allies would have loved it. It would have made the people ready to aid the Allies in any way. And instead, it took a vast underground Allied spy network of non-Czechs to get information as the people refused to help. And I had a look, I looked up the Wikipedia page on Reinhard Heydrich, and it is full of lots of, oh, what an evil person he is. But when he was attacked, it was a Czech woman that brought aid to him and got him to the hospital, a Czech peasant woman. And if he was hated by the Czechs, she would have just left him there. She wouldn't have gone out of the way.
Quite brave as well, I believe, because I think he chased the people and eventually got killed there, but certainly wasn't afraid of going after him.
Yeah, instead of just racing off after they shot at him because they made a mistake, he stopped the car and tried to go after them, and I think they threw a grenade. And he was badly hit, and this peasant woman got him to the hospital, and then he sort of came around, and I think Hitler went to visit him, or Himmler went to visit him, and then he said, well, you know, if this is the end, then this is the end. I mean, he was a courageous man. Right to the end. I'd like to learn more about Reinhard Heydrich, actually. He sounds like an interesting character.
It certainly does.
Only Czechs motivated by politics, mainly communists and Jews, were the resistance. So that sounds like France, doesn't it? During the funeral for Heydrich... only they were actually not even in France. French resistance were in Britain. During the funeral for Heydrich, thousands upon thousands of Czechs turned out to bid him farewell. The real reason he was killed was that he was just so good. The English then spread disinformation to us, saying it was Czech partisans rising up with help from the people. Those in charge fell for that claim and came down harshly on people, even if just by rumour, something Heydrich would have been against, as he would have wanted hard evidence. Now, that may be referring to something I read in Wikipedia. Now, I don't know if this is true or not. It says that they traced... Or they thought they got where the origins of this assassin was, and it was these two villages, and they just wiped out everyone in those villages. And what she seems to be saying here is that he wouldn't have wanted that. He would have wanted hard evidence before going after anyone. Yeah. So a noble man. France was the same way. She says France was the same way. The people were treated very well. Only the diehard communists formed a resistance, which the average French person wanted no part of. My father was proud of the French, who sent many people to help us, either in the factories or at the front. So yes, there were those opposed to German rule, but many more were receptive to the ideas of National Socialism and saw a future that was very bright for all Europeans. It is too bad we were not given the luxury of being able to unoccupy these people and turn them over to true National Socialist leaders. The war made the occupation necessary to secure our borders from enemy invasion. So that's, you know, telling us about this plan that they had for after the war, and it would have been a liberated Europe, liberated from the banks and National Socialist. And the other bit here I find interesting, she says about how the French sent many people to help them, either in the factories or at the front. And in the First World War, there were people from Belgium, and the propaganda reports say, oh, these Belgian people, the Germans locked them up as prisoners. But they didn't. They actually volunteered. And a lot of them were volunteering to work in the factories, which were in these camps, and they were actually being paid. So where it says there, you know, these factories... Most of the sort of factory areas, like in Auschwitz, they were actually in the work camps. So there might well have been people that actually come over to work in these factories that we're told, oh, it was slave labor, but the French were actually, you know, moving to Germany so that they could help with the war effort.
Yeah, there was quite a lot of hatred after the war as well from the resistance. There's a case of, you know, one American soldier was talking in one. I read another interview, and he said he saw a crowd turning on these women. And he says there was a one particular woman, very beautiful, like knocked to the floor and kicked to death. And he had to turn away. And they were told not to interfere as an American. So a lot of revenge going on, as again, I tried to show in The Great Story.
Oh, I think when the Germans came in and they liberated places like Lithuania and Latvia, I think most of the communists had left by then. But because I guess some of them were still there, then yeah, they took their vengeance after what the communists yep. had done to them. And the same once the communists came back, they obviously took their revenge on.
Revenge, yeah.
Again. Like a vicious cycle. Well, the next bit is Christianity and the church. It's a very interesting bit. She says, "This is somewhat hard to explain to someone who is not German, but I will try. My father had a vision of a people turning back to their creator, who gave us everything we know. Our people, the Europeans, have created all the great civilizations, have set foot on every continent, and have brought great good to the whole world. We are leaps and bounds ahead of any other peoples, including the advanced Orientals. My father asked the questions as to why, where, and how. He commissioned the studies of our history to trace the footsteps of our ancestors. Where did they originate, and why were they so intelligent and advanced when other races stayed the same?" And of course, this is what we talk about, the fact that Europeans haven't always been in Europe. You know, that's why we don't call them Europeans. We call them white people or Aryans, because just the word European limits things. It says, well, these people have only ever lived in Europe. They're from Europe. And we came from the East. We came from the warmer areas, which is where all the civilizations began. Obviously, all began by white people, but it's all brown people that live there now. And that's why they live among the ruins of the civilization. Because that's what happens when you miscegenate. You lose that spark that you have as a white man. So that was Himmler's idea. And she says, Germany had some of the most advanced anthropologists, genetic scientists, historians, and supporting staff to help find the answers as to why we exist and how it all came to be. My father was religious and raised us to be also. A being is responsible for life. That is very easy to see because of what it is, nature and the beauty of the earth. Nature is clear about that. The problem or question is who he is. Every race was given a way to worship their creator. The European people found a god who worked well for us for 2,000 years. My father's concern was that in just the last 200 years, Jews have wormed their way into our religion, even to the point of working on translating parts of the Bible to suit their needs. So that confirms that he was a Christian, and what he was against was the way that the church was over the last 200 years and what the Jews had done.
How many people believe he was pagan? They've all been told he was pagan.
Well, that's nonsense. I mean, who are you going to believe, the Allies, or are you going to believe his daughter?
And me. Right.
Yeah. Well, you've dug this out without actually, you know, hearing about this interview.
Quotes. Yeah. He quotes about Jesus. Another tells the SS, you know, that you can't criticize Christ.
Even working on translating parts of the Bible to suit their needs. And, of course, we talked about that a couple of episodes back, didn't we?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's only the last couple of hundred years, like she says.
She says they were then able to convince leaders that the Bible is really about the Jew and not about Europeans. We are only secondary, along with all the other Gentiles. It's got Gentiles in quote marks. This made no sense to my father, as Jews do not have any of the marks of a creative, industrious people. I have met people from your country who agree that the Jews cannot be the people of the Bible, or that the Bible is only for the Jew, who denounce and hate Christ. We Europeans took his name, hence every European nation is a Christian nation. My father did not hate the church or persecute the church. What he disagreed with was the Judeo influence on the church. Germany had some sects who worshipped the Jew as the only people close to God. And I think that makes it clear that she saw the Bible as a European book, and Christianity mm-hmm. as totally European, not Jewish at all. This idea that it was Jewish has only come about in the last 200 years.
Yeah, so when these pagans say, you know, we're cooks to the Jews, then it's ridiculous.
And also that this is the way that Himmler felt. You know, he didn't hate the church.
The great pagan, yeah.
Yeah, it disagreed with the Jewish influence. Well, this is what I say. You know, we've got a Jewish influence in politics, but we don't say, well, let's get rid of government. Let's get rid of parliament. We'll have to find something new. So why do we say, well, let's get rid of, we've got Jews involved in Christianity. So why do we say, well, let's get rid of Christianity? You know, it doesn't make sense. They're involved in everything. And what we have to do is remove their influence from everything. It doesn't mean, you know, you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater too, which is what saying get rid of Christianity basically is. She says, right. The SS idea was to turn our people back to their roots from where they came and away from the modern Judeo church, who was seen as a destructive Trojan horse to weaken the people and turn them from their God. And that's just it, isn't it? The Antichrist say that's what Christianity is. But sensible people that have looked into this understand that it's just this modern church that's become that, and it always served us well before then. And that was the way that Himmler saw it. It's the modern Judeo church, which is the destructive Trojan horse. The German Christians were a good start, and my father attended many services by pastors who understood the Jewish influence on the Christian religion was not a good thing and led to false teachings. Therefore, my father respected the church. Many SS officers were Catholic, and he had no wish to anger Christians. He did, however, want people to see another side of the church that was not healthy for the people. It became lazy, drenched in liberal thought, even suggesting homosexuals should be allowed in society and that race does not matter to the creator who created the races. Germans have always revered our history. You will see in our very old cathedrals images from our Germanic past, the gods our ancestors prayed to. And it is all tied into our modern worldview of religion. We worship God by thanking him for our history and honouring our ancestors who brought us forward into the age we are in. And I think that explains it, because the pagan types will say, well, I had all this pagan imagery. Well, they were using these runes. Well, they were talking about Odin and what have you. Well, the cathedrals have got images of Odin in them and the crows and the green man and... Because there are cathedrals, so they reflect our culture. Christianity absorbed all of that. So when the National Socialists were using this imagery, it's out of respect for their past. It's not saying, well, we want to get rid of Christianity and go back.
And go back.
Yeah. Go backwards. You know, go back to being children again.
Exactly.
You know, it's like wanting to go back to primary school again after you've been through secondary school and university and say, well, no, we're just going to go back to being primary school level of education again. It, you know, our religious ideas are continually evolving. And I think the problem is people think that Christianity was somehow alien and was brought in by foreigners. And that all comes from this idea that it comes from Jews.
Exactly.
Totally false. She's quite a good woman, this Gudrun. I mean, I do wonder if, you know, maybe these are her ideas, but if they were her ideas, then why would she be saying that, you know, this is what her father thought? Because she's a woman of her own right. She could say, well, you know, these are my ideas. He thought slightly different, but she's not. She's saying these are his ideas.
Correct. Which
is an important point. And then she talks about the Ahnenerbe and Wevelsburg Castle. She says the Ahnenerbe, supposedly, the Ahnenerbe was nothing but an archaeological research institute run by the SS. They went all over the world looking into the history of the Europeans and looking for evidence of the paths the tribes took coming into Europe. They found evidence of European, who can also be called Aryan, mummies in Tibet and China, Iran, and all over what we call Persia or the Middle East. They tested Egyptian theories and found most of all the dynasties were European bloodlines and not African. Some went to South America looking for evidence of Europeans there, as well as in America. They believed Columbus was not the first European on the continent, and indeed the Vikings may not have been the first either. There was evidence uncovered that tribes of Europeans were there thousands of years ago. The Anunnaki studied all aspects and theories of creation and evolution, the origin of races, and traced the paths of the early Aryans who went on to form the 12 main tribes of the European nations. They had compatriots all over the world, in every nation. I met some from Scotland and America who were very interested in the work Dr. Jordan headed. Nothing sinister about looking into your past to see about improving your future. So they found the evidence of all of this. Tibet, China, Iran, Persia, Middle East, and they found evidence of the original people there being Aryan.
Which has been subdued again.
Yeah, they tried to hide today. And I think where she's saying there, you know, white people in America before the Vikings, I think that was probably the Phoenicians. There's talk of the Phoenicians having open cast having mines over there in America. There's evidence of them and Phoenician writing in parts of America. So they could have been there, you know, 500 years before the Vikings. But we're just told, oh, it was Christopher Columbus and maybe the Vikings. But I think those the Aztecs and the Incas, and there's evidence that there were white people there before them as well. Some of the statues, and also when they found some of these tribes, they had like red hair and blue eyes. Obviously, they were mixed race peoples, but they were still showing these traces of the white people that had been there originally.
And I think churches were down in South America as well. There's been some evidence of them migrating.
Could well be. And then you got the Solutrians as well. You know, I think they're from thousands of years back, and they've got the same arrowheads as the early tribes in France had, sort of just after the Ice Age. Whether or not they're white, I don't know. They say it was about 10,000 years ago, but it was the same people that were in France that were also in America. So
I think the problem is that this current regime, shall we say, is out to destroy history. We're talking not long back about in Sweden, they were destroying some Viking relics. You know, they don't want us to know about our ancestry or our history, because obviously they've got something to hide. And if you don't know your history, you know, you think like an animal and just look for your next round of food.
Yeah, if people realised that originally all these places in the world, they started out white, then, you know, they'd be making a fuss about all these peoples coming into our homelands now, because they realise that it's history repeating itself, and they'd see what the effect of it is. You know, the end result of multiculturalism is basically India, Egypt, Syria, Iraq.
Yeah.
That's how it ends up. Those places today living among the ruins of a previous civilization. And then she's asked about Wevelsburg. She says, I was around many, if not all, of the high leaders of the SS. So you could say I know more about the organization my father founded than most. There was nothing sinister about any of these organizations. Wevelsburg was nothing but a retreat and research center for SS men. They were to be the new vanguard of a genetic repopulation of Germany to make up for the losses of the First War and its aftermath. The Jews promoted a genetic cesspool where everyone was encouraged to breed, no matter if you had a defect or not. But healthy women were also encouraged to abort their healthy babies. This was their way to weaken a nation's gene pool and kill off the best of the best, making their conquest easier. The blood and soil concept was a back to the roots of our ancestors' idea. It was in this that our gene pool would be repaired. Wevelsburg was set up so an SS member could study all about our history, our genetic makeup that makes us who we are, and how to preserve it. It was to be a place of honour for high SS leaders, so that future generations could honour the sacrifices they made to bring us a better world through National Socialism. So it wasn't some black magic palace for having pagan rites in.
That was a good excuse for the libraries and things there, though.
Didn't they have replicas of some of the relics there?
Himmler did, yeah. They even had a chapel. The Allies removed the chapel.
And that image of the Black Sun, you know, that I think that's representative of Christ. He's the light.
Well, it's not even
see.
Black, it's green.
Yeah, it's green. And it's just the symbol of it. You know, like
I think it represents the Last Supper, 12 people at the Last Supper, I believe.
You can fit in with it as well. But it's like the reversal of light. You know, halos that when they draw saints and the icons and they have like a yellow halo around their head, that should be a black sun, I think, because it's not a material light that's coming out of their heads. It's a spiritual light that you can't see. That is where the material light comes from, if you were. Like the sun itself is a shadow of the spiritual sun, the black sun. Everything that we see is a shadow of the real spiritual existence, which is in eternity, and where we live is mortal. I think it symbolizes all of that. And there's even a verse in, I think it's 2 Timothy, where it says that Christ is the light that no man has ever seen. And then it talks about, there is no material sun in the afterlife. There is a light that comes from somewhere, and it's obviously a light that we can't see, but it's the light that gives us life. Because you know, you can have a dead body and you can put the sun on it. It's not going to bring that body back to life. It's not the material sun that gives us life. It's God that gives us life. And if you put up just a material sun, the temptation is for people to see it as that, rather than see that as representative of God. So if you have a black sun, it's not something that already exists, so it can't be sort of idolized. And I think it's a fantastic symbol for God. Just that people get mixed up because they don't actually see past the most obvious thing. And with any of these symbols, they've all got esoteric concepts behind them, not, you know, sort of the most obvious thing.
Well, notice recently there's been another push with science, you know, where they're saying that the universe, there was definitely a Big Bang, which was once a theory. Now it's taught in schools as reality. Seems to be a push again. Certainly on YouTube, I was watching videos a while back, and some scientists were obviously convinced of what they were talking about. But what that was once, like I say, once just a thought. Now it's a fact in schools.
And who was it that flicked the switch for the Big Bang to happen?
Well, nothing can't create anything. Nothing is nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's it, isn't it? That's the thing.
Something has got to create it. Yeah.
Something can't come out of nothing. And all the scientific theories of evolution, Big Bang, it's all something out of nothing. So it fails.
Well, it's the first time in history that an explosion has created life with their way of explaining things.
Yeah, that's sort of quite the opposite of what you expect, isn't it?
Yeah.
Usually death and carnage. Well, it's like mutations when they say, well, cells mutate and they evolve. Well, the only mutations we know of are cancer. They're not anything positive. You don't suddenly mutate wings and become an angel that can fly. You end up with bowel cancer, you know, or breast cancer or something. That's what happens when your cells start mutating. You don't gradually evolve into something else. You know, all of their theories, when you actually think about them, they go against what you actually see in nature. And yet they've managed to convince everyone they're true, because it's all temptation to believe them. So the weight is on their side, because it's temptation to get you to believe something that's wrong. You know, they people are tempted to believe it because we live in this corrupted world. You know, as Christ told us, or the devil told us, he owns all the kingdoms in the world, and Christ didn't challenge him on that. You know, the devil does run everything in this world, in this material world. That's why he's here. That's who kicked out of heaven. So he's here in earth with us, along with his angels. So, of course, he has the power here. So lies will have a lot of power, but you can see through them.
Well, I was watching Joe Rogan on YouTube again, and he was saying about Christ that he's just a dead cult leader. Obviously, he's a Freemason, so he will say that. But he also pushes this agenda as well. is, you know, just working for the obvious people.
So many of them do. They claim to be, you know, fighting against the New World Order or whatever, and then they subscribe to New Age religions. Or exactly. They subscribe to, you know, pagan gods. And all these Masonic places have got pagan gods outside them. You know, the EU itself has got pagan gods outside of it. And you've got these people, you know, claiming to be against them that worship this stuff. Well, you know, maybe these pagan gods don't want them worshipping, because it's the people like the EU and the Freemasons that get all the blessings from them for worshipping them. And the nationalists that claim to be worshipping the pagans, they don't get any blessings from them. Yeah,
exactly.
And you get with our traditions and get with Christianity. Well, the last question here was about Himmler committing suicide. She said, no, I heard enough evidence by speaking with my father's friends and those who were with him until the end. He had so much knowledge of the war, what started it, how it was fought, dirt on heads of state, and most of all, the work with the Jews to help remove inmates from overcrowded camps. This does not fit with the Allied version of extermination of the Jews, because he knew so much and could disprove all Allied claims against Germany and the Führer. He was killed on Churchill's orders, I believe, to keep him from talking. My father was not like his friend Dr. Goebbels, who believed we could work with the Allies after the war to combat communism and had nothing to fear. He told my mother to stay at our home and to advise any Allied soldier we were the family of Reichsfuhrer SS Heinrich Himmler, and we would be safe. So he had a bit of a rose-tinted view of the Allies here, I think, Dennis.
They got it wrong, yeah.
Were you aware of
really
that?
Wrong.
You were aware of that before, that he felt
that
way?
Yeah, I think David Irving went into great detail about the killing of Himmler. He believes that he actually saw the death mask, which was taken of Himmler, and it looked like someone had been badly beaten up. So he was convinced that he was murdered.
And also, didn't Hitler turn against Himmler for trying to make peace?
Yeah, he did, and with the Luftwaffe.
Goering.
Goering, that's right. But again, like I said, I'd also read Goering's daughter's interview, and she kind of claimed that there was a lot of misunderstanding going around then with all the bombing, and Hitler was isolated and wasn't exactly how it's been portrayed. That's what she said.
Well, Gudrun continues. She says, Dr. Goebbels killed his family because he believed they would end up like Mussolini and his children would be raped and mistreated by Soviet soldiers and Jews. My father had no worries like that for us. He believed the Western Allies were good and would come to their senses as to the danger in the East. He was wrong in this, and our captors mistreated us. They withheld food and water, hygiene items, groped my mother and me, threatened us with rape, and said I would be sent to Russia. So Goebbels was right, wasn't he?
Yeah, Himmler wasn't the only one, of course, because like we know down in the Balkans how they struggled to surrender to the Allies in the West rather than the communists, and then they were sent straight back again. So, you know, there was kind of a myth that if you surrendered to the Americans or the British, you'd be safe, and it turned out to be what it was, a myth.
And she was lucky to survive, really. I think she was lucky to survive. And I'm not so certain that maybe it was because of what Magda Goebbels did. It may have actually helped Gudrun to survive, because the Allies would have wanted to portray Magda Goebbels as doing that unnecessarily. Evil. Yeah, yeah. And evil for doing it. So therefore, if they didn't harm the children of Himmler, then they could then portray Magda Goebbels as being really evil and having done this, you know, unnecessarily.
Yeah.
Whereas I think
good point.
I think she did have a good reason to be scared of what would happen after what happened with, sure, with Mussolini, and obviously the mistreatment to everybody else. She says, I have had people reach out to the men who claimed they buried my father to see if they can lead us to his grave. They are typical English, where they believe him to be their enemy and a very bad man, and they have no desire to help. This shows how powerful the propaganda is. They become heartless because they believe they are saving the world from evil. They have no idea that they were the evil ones, fighting an evil war against an innocent nation and its people. And that's the problem, isn't it? You know, I've been saying this for a while.
Still strong today.
Yeah, our virtue gets used against us. Our good nature gets used against us, and we get deceived into thinking that we're standing up for what's right, and in actual fact, we're standing up for what's wrong. You know, these people that call for open borders and rescuing the refugees, that's because we don't want to see people dying, we don't want to see people ill or what have you. But that should be only for our own people. If you extend that to others, then it then becomes a threat to our own people, and they're damaging us by doing that. And each one of them that comes into Europe is displacing one of us. And it's the same.
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think when you said that they're trying to turn Europe into what they did with the cities and nations down in the Middle East, I think that's exactly what they're trying to do. They've done it before. They know how to do it, and they know how to get away with it. And at the moment, they're succeeding.
Well, it's the same people, isn't it? You know, I think yes. Whatever names they go by, it's always been the same people. It's always been these bankers and these people at the top and these merchants that haven't actually been a part of the nation that they're living among, that seek to subvert that nation and corrupt them. And if they can, get them to interbreed and become mixed race like them.
Yeah.
And eventually turn the whole world mixed race. And that is out of a hatred of God. It's out of an absolute hatred of God, the Creator.
Yes, you're right.
And that's the way they can get their own back on God, isn't it? Is by permanently destroying His creation. So that,
the problem is the churches don't, if they do realize, they don't mention it. You know, they kind of go along with everything as was said for the last couple of hundred years, and it's not going to do Europe any good because you know if they're going to hide these lies and agendas, it's only going to lead to the destruction of the white race.
Well, it's like she said earlier, God is the author of race. God is the creator of race, and yet the churches today are promoting the destruction of God's creation by interbreeding. Yeah. I mean, that law at the beginning in Genesis, it says kind after kind, and it says kind after kind about 10 times. It doesn't say kind out of kind. I mean, that's what we have now. They have made kinds out of the kinds that God created. And these kinds that have been made out of those kinds, they're a corruption of God's creation. They weren't created by God in that image. They've been recreated in man's image, which is, you know, God can't be held responsible for that. That's temptation of the devil to break the laws of nature and corrupt his creation. And once that's done, yeah, there's nothing that can be done about it. It's got to be the most evil, most wicked thing that's ever been done in the history of the world is the blending of the races to create new kinds out of the kinds that God created. And we have to be thankful that, we're still here and we're still created in the image of God. And that there's fewer and fewer.
For now,
But we are still here. And we'll be here next Friday as well with more Truthful Out Radio. Dennis, thank you very much for coming on today.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next Friday with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great summer weekend ahead of you.